Good morning, everyone.
We're reading in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 5, the Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. And we're coming towards the end of this stage of King Aswapati's yoga. We've been reading how, through the intense aspiration that he has conceived from his secret knowledge of the purpose of the universe, he's conceived this great will and hope that it would be possible to bring down the highest level of consciousness and make it normal here on Earth. And as a result of that intense aspiration of his to make himself fit for this great mission, there's been a descent, a transforming descent into his whole nature. And a result of that transformation, he has become aware of this secret nature, this nature which is not our ordinary earth nature, neither is it the higher divine nature. It is something intermediary. And because of his great realization and this transformation, that nature, who can be quite dubious and dangerous, has surrendered all her powers to his spiritual will. This bizarre kingdom of the intermediate worlds, at the bottom of page 86, passed into his charge. He's made responsible for it. Page 86 at the bottom. And we read that this secret nature, like one resisting more, the more she loves, her great possessions and her power and love she gave, compelled with a reluctant joy, because she has to. She's resisting, but she has to yield. Herself she gave for rapture and for use. As a result, this secret nature is absolved, set free, washed, completely pure of aberration in deep ways. She's been wandering here and there in dark paths. Now, with King Aswapati, she recovered the ends, the purposes for which she was made. She turned against the evil she had helped. She turns against it her engined wrath, her invisible means to slay, her dangerous moods and arbitrary force. She surrendered to the service of the soul and the control of a spiritual will. A greater despot tamed her despotism. A despot is an arbitrary ruler, who's not answerable to anybody. So she has been acting despotically and arbitrarily, but now she surrenders to the despotism of the soul and the spiritual will. She is tamed by King Aswapati, assailed, surprised in the fortress of herself, conquered by her own unexpected king, fulfilled and ransomed by her servitude. She yielded in a vanquished ecstasy. Her sealed hermetic wisdom forced from her fragments of the mystery of omnipotence. This last sentence recalls legends such as the legend of Chitrangada and Arjuna in the Mahabharata, where she's the ruler, but as part of his work for Sri Krishna, he conquers her kingdom. And just like Chitrangada, this secret nature
yields in a vanquished ecstasy, and all her powers, her secret occult wisdom, she's forced to share it with him. That is not omnipotence, it's not the highest knowledge, but it represents fragments, small pieces of the mystery of omnipotence. So now we shall read a little bit more about that that secret nature. Yes.
I'm trying to articulate something. Please.
Can everybody hear the Ramnarayan? Please speak.
This is a secret nature. This could be understood from the tantric tantric aspect is secret, part of secret nature. And if this is all the secret nature has already surrendered, Sri Aurobindo has conquered. So at this point of time, the power tantra wouldn't be working. Any tantric may not succeed in his endeavor to do that. Another question I would like to ask.
Was that the first question?
Yeah, another part of it. When mother was working with Deo, and he interfered in her the achievement, and then mother also succeeded defeating his. And does it relate to the same time what Sri Aurobindo writes here, and are these related?
I think what Sri Aurobindo is giving here is Aswapati as an example of what can happen to the liberated soul. He hasn't gone seeking occult knowledge and powers. They've come to him as a result of the spiritual transformation of his whole being, his inner being and outer being. Very naturally, this knowledge, this secret nature has had to surrender to him. So I'm sure that something like this has happened in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. I can't say exactly when, but I think I mentioned in an earlier week, a couple of weeks, that I connect this secret nature with the mother of dreams. Both Sri Aurobindo and the mother refer to the mother of dreams. He has written a beautiful poem. He composed that poem when he was in Alipur jail, and it seems he wrote it down only later. It's a really remarkable poem, but perhaps it belongs to that period of 1908 to 1909. And Mother uses this same phrase, the Mother of Dreams, in one of her prayers and meditations, and she was asked about it. She replied something which corresponds to this, that she's like a mysterious sphinx who confronts the seeker with existential questions. But if he can answer her question like the sphinx, then he becomes the master. She has to surrender to him. And that sphinx, Sri Aurobindo refers to her or it, I think, four times in the poem on different levels of experience. But it's always the same nature, a mysterious, secret, female power who challenges you to the very core of your being. You have to answer her question in order to survive, in order to go further on your quest. So this passage here represents Aswapati's conquest in that process. And we will see that it leads on, this mastery that he gains in this way, leads on to the next stage in his journey, which is his ability to enter not just this borderland, but the whole range of subtle worlds and travel freely among them. This is a kind of transitional passage leading to that. So I think we'll start reading at the top this side today. Please, Patty, would you read from the break on page 87?
A border sovereign is the occult force, a threshold guardian of the earth's scenes beyond. She has canalized the outbreaks of the gods and cut through vistas of intuitive sight, a long road of shimmering discoveries. The worlds of a marvelous unknown were near. Behind her, an ineffable presence stood. Her reign received their mystic influences. Their lion forces crouched beneath her feet. The future sleeps unknown behind their doors. Abysms infernal gaped round the soul's steps and called to its mounting vision peaks divine. An endless climb, an adventure of the idea. There tirelessly tempted the explorer mind, and countless voices visited the charmed ear. A million figures passed and were seen no more.
Thank you. So here Schopenhauer puts it very, very clearly, no? That this secret nature is a border sovereign. She rules the borderline, the frontiers, and the threshold. She's the guardian of the threshold of the earth scenes beyond. What lies beyond our material universe? If we step over that threshold, we enter her realm, or we enter the realm of the beyond, the subtle worlds. So from her position there, on the borderline, on the threshold, she has canalized, she's channeled outbreaks of the gods, as if there are sometimes explosions or outpourings from the overmind. She's cut through vistas of intuitive sight. So standing on the threshold, one can see great panoramas with the intuitive vision. And there she's set out or revealed a long road of shimmering discoveries. So Asvapati becomes aware that the worlds of a marvelous unknown were near to him at that moment. And he becomes aware that behind her, behind this secret nature, this border sovereign, there's an ineffable presence, a very, very powerful, supreme presence. That must be the higher divine nature. So her reign here on this borderline, her reign receives mystic influences from those unknown worlds, from those gods, and their forces, like lions, they are ready to serve her. They come around, they are ready to let her put her feet on them, make use of them. The future sleeps unknown behind the doors of those worlds. And where Asvapati is standing now, on the threshold, abysms, infernal, hellish depth are opening up around the soul's steps. One can fall in, perhaps, to those infernal depths. That's what is below. And above, he becomes aware of this vision of divine peak. Higher and higher and higher levels of divine power. So the possibility of an endless climb and adventure of the idea there tirelessly tempted the explorer mind. Standing on that threshold, endless possibilities are open. Countless voices visited the charmed ear. We feel attracted by many different voices, and wonderful visions pass and are seen no more. This is what Sri Aurobindo describes in his poem, The Mother of Dreams. Anybody would like to ask anything?
He said that the secret nature is also dangerous and dangerous.
Yes.
And then, so it is like behind her an inevitable presence too. So it is under form of the secret nature, or?
It is what? Sorry.
Yes,
it's her true origin. No? She is like a delegate on this borderline of that ineffable presence. The ineffable presence is standing behind her, supporting her. It has allowed all her aberrations in deep ways, but now it has brought her under the control of a spiritual will. Is that what? Yes. So where Aspapati is standing now, it's, he says, a forefront of God's thousandfold house. Let's read about that. Would you read? Thank you. This was a forefront. It's in front of, it's the entranceway of God's thousandfold house, the universe of so many different worlds and rooms and chambers and possibilities. It's the beginnings of the half-screened invisible. Aspapati can half see through that screen towards the invisible worlds. So at the entrance, there's first of all a porch, you know, and a huge mansion. There will always be in front of the door, there will be a sheltered area so that when you have to stand and wait to move into the door, you don't, the rain or the sun doesn't disturb you. So this is a magic porch of entry, glimmering. He sees it, shimmering, faint light, quivering in a penumbra of screened light. A penumbra is a twilight, a half-light. I remember Mother's talks describing what she wanted for the inner chamber. She said the light in there should be a penumbra, a twilight of screened light. And beyond the porch, there's a courtyard. A huge courtyard where all kinds of beings from all the different thousandfold rooms of God's house are coming and going. It's a place where the influences and powers of all the different worlds meet and exchange. A court of the mystical traffic of the worlds. And on the facade of the building, of the entrance, there's a balcony. And this facade is so beautiful, beyond the courtyard, the facade, the balcony. In the palaces of kings and sovereigns and heads of state, there's usually a balcony in the facade. People can gather below all around without entering the building, and they can be blessed or they can view the ruler standing in the balcony. And above the balcony, above where she stands, he sees high immensities, vast realms becoming lighter and lighter as they go higher. And from that kind of tower are looking down all the unknown, looked out from boundlessness, from those many levels of immensity. It makes me think of the gopurams above the entrance to a temple. If you look at them carefully, there are always these many levels, and each level represents a world, and looking out from those worlds are the beings and the creatures and the powers of those worlds are looking down. So he sees something like that they are lodged upon an edge of hourless time, some limitless, immeasurable time. And these beings are gazing out of some everlasting now. For them it is always the present. So he sees these shadows, the shadows of this tower. They are gleaming with the birth of gods. Divine beings are just emerging and showing themselves. The bodies of those beings are signaling, they're just representing powers which are really bodiless. The foreheads of those beings are glowing with the light of the oversoul. The forms that are there are projected from that unknowable, that great mystery beyond everything. The eyes are dreaming of the ineffable, the reality that can never be put into words. Its faces are staring into eternity. It's a first glimpse of the world stare, which he's going to be able to examine much more in detail in book two. Patricia.
Life in him learned its huge subconscient here, the little fronts unlocked to the unseen vast, her gulfs stood near, her far transcendences flamed in transparencies of crowded light.
We'll pause there. Who is this she, her? This is life, the life power in Asvapati. When she sees all this facade and this tower, the life force and power in him learns and recognizes its own huge subconscious rear, all the life powers that the surface being is not aware of. So vast. So the little fronts of this forefront of God's thousandfold house are opened, unlocked, and begin to reveal the unseen vast. So the gulfs of life, the deeper levels, are made naked, shown clearly. And above her far transcendences, the highest possible expressions of life are flaming in transparencies of crowded light, packed with many different shades and hues of transparent light so that all can be seen at the same time. Which lines are you asking about?
Above her.
Yes, what I imagine here is this secret nature standing like the queen on the balcony. So that's how I'm understanding that. But here at the bottom of the section, it clearly says it is life, the life in him, in Asvapati. Yes, learned. All its deeper possibilities. The Supreme Divine Mother expresses herself in the manifestation as nature, as the creative force, as life, and she expresses herself differently on many different levels, but that's the ineffable presence which is standing behind this secret nature. And the secret nature expresses herself in life possibilities, in the dynamism of life. It is all the mother. The mother is the dynamic force, but She has so many, many different ways of self-expression. One of them is as the life goddess. Well, a particular life force or the life force of a particular world is the expression of the nature of that world, the expression of the creative force that's behind that world. I'm sorry, dear, I didn't hear clearly. Asvapati, yes. You could. He becomes aware of much greater possibilities of his life energies than he's been aware of so far. We know that he's the lord of the horse. Well, it is a new kind of knowledge that comes to him. That knowledge will be described in this last canto we'll read, this last section of the canto we'll read about that. But we can think about his name, that it means the Lord of energy, and particularly the life energies. And it's because he's able to control his life energies. For most of us, life runs away with us, and our life impulses run away with us. That's his great power of tapasya and will that is able to carry him to higher and higher levels of consciousness and existence. So here in this borderland, he's becoming aware of depths, gulfs, deep places, and far distant transcendent states that he had not known about before, perhaps glimpsed, but now he can see them flaming above there more clearly. And as a result of that, he's able to see other things much more clearly too. Lady at the back, would you like to read?
I have a question.
Yes, but will you read, ma'am? Yes. Yeah. Wait a moment, we'll hear Prasad's question.
Number 5001, gazing out of some everlasting now. For us, it's an ever fleeting now.
Yes. Yes. So that's the difference between us and the immortal beings. No.
So who can? Who's? There is no present if it is everlasting.
Yes, but it means past, present, and future is ever present to them. All together. Yeah.
A giant order was discovered here, of which the tassel and extended fringe are the scant stuff of our material lives. This overt universe, whose figures hide the secrets merged in superconscient light, wrote here the letters of its glowing gold. A map of subtle signs surpassing thought was hung upon a wall of inmost mind, illumining the world's concrete images into significant symbols by its gloss. It offered to the intuitive
exegete.
It's a reflex of the eternal mystery.
Thank you. So Asvapati revealed to him is a giant order. And only the tassel, the extended fringe, the little edge bit, is the scant stuff of our material lives. There's so much more. This overt universe that we see and perceive with our senses, all these sense impressions and appearances hide secrets that are merged in superconscient light. So we can't see them. If we look for them, our eyes are dazzled. They can only be revealed to a much higher consciousness. But now, for Asvapati, all these figures, these secrets, wrote clear the letters of its glowing code, the code which reveals the secret meaning of this overt universe. that we perceive. These are all secret letters, signs, images for hidden truths. No? And he's able to read the code. And he sees it also like a map on the wall of a schoolroom, a map of subtle signs that go beyond thought. It's as if this map is hung on the wall of inmost mind, his deep innermost mind. And that map and that code, they illumine, they light up all these concrete images of the world into significant symbols. He can see the secret meaning. What do they mean? When you see the Auroville symbol or the mother's symbol or Sri Aurobindo's symbol for the first time, you don't know what they mean. Only when somebody explains them to you, you see what a deep significance is there in those simple signs. No? So it's like that. He can see the meaning of all these signs. So this map offered to the intuitive exegete its reflex of the eternal mystery. An exegete is somebody who can explain something. So, yes, I feel a bit ashamed of thinking that I'm an exegete, but in a way, and Mother didn't really approve of exegesis, of explanations of Sri Aurobindo's thought and teachings. So I think what I'm doing is explaining only his poetic language as far as I can understand it. You have to understand from your own what these words and images mean to you. Sorry? No, can be philosophical matters or anything. So, but for this, to read this map, you have to be an intuitive exegete. You have to be able to read it and explain it with intuition. And what you are explaining is its reflex, its reflection, its connection with the eternal mystery. That mystery will always remain eternal, but these signs of our world do have certain connections, and we can become aware of those, perhaps. So as a result of being able to read that code and that map, Aswapati discovers this giant order which is underlying the whole universe, not only the physical universe, but all the subtle worlds too. And I consider these next lines to be among the most important in Savitri from the point of view of understanding and remembering Sri Aurobindo's vision. Shalini, would you read?
Thank you.
So there's a double movement going on, ascending and descending. Between the poles, the extremes of life, there's a series. All the kingdoms of the graded law. The law is graded according to each step. A grade can be a step. They're in a series, an orderly series. This is a giant order. And they have plunged from the everlasting into time. That's the movement of manifestation and creation and involution. Step by step, all these grades have come down. And then there's the movement back. This is so interesting to me, that they climb back, and somehow in the descent and the ascent, they have gained something. As they climb back, they are glad of a glory of multitudinous mind. This is the many, rich with life's adventure and delight, and packed with the beauty of matters, shapes, and hues. These steps climb back from time into undying self. And how does the climb, how as it is it happened, there's a ladder. All these steps form a golden ladder that the soul can climb up. And that golden ladder makes a connection with its diamond threads. It ties the spirit's extremes, the extreme from spirit to matter. So in the downward journey, in this drop from consciousness to consciousness, each of the steps, each of the levels, relies on the power of the occult inconscient, because from there comes its needed ignorance. Each of the levels going down is a little bit more unconscious, a little bit more ignorant than the one above it. That it's the inconscient, is its, or the ignorance, that is the arch mason, the master builder of the limits by which each of those steps, levels, lives. And on the upward journey, each of the levels is lifting its highest levels to the level above it, the one from which it has come, the origin of everything that it has ever been. And the home, the level above, is the home of everything that it could still become, its future possibilities. Well, because there's an intention. This drop from consciousness to consciousness is not accidental, it's intended, this whole evolutionary process. So to make each of these steps more limited than the one above, that ignorance, isn't that power of unconsciousness and ignorance is needed. We were reading in the Life Divine, that this is a deliberate, voluntary movement of self-limitation of consciousness at each step.
The inconscious power would be then also arguing the inner fire or aspiration.
Of course, Agni is the power that helps us do the climb. Concentration. Of course, elsewhere, soon we will come to it. Sri Aurobindo will tell us this giant order has been created by a voluntary plunge of the Supreme Divine Mother down into the opposite extreme, and on the way all these levels have been created. That's another way of looking at it. And so in the lowest level, in matter, the densest level, all the potentialities of all the higher levels are compressed and they're ready to evolve. Yes? I'm not hearing you very well, Lorraine.
The quality of a mountain climber.
Yes.
Why do they do this? Because they're on the bottom.
Because it's there.
It's there.
Yes. That's what they say, no? Right. Yeah. Yes. And of course it's because the origin is really from above. So that memory of the origin in however obscure a way is there even in matter. And it's that urge to mound up again, to rediscover all the things that can go on the way. And last week we had this figure of the, no, it was on the, in the Thursday class. We had this figure of the two-in-one, spirit and nature, in the figure of of infinity. And Mother had asked Hooter to show that, like a figure of eight. At the top, there are two little faces, the Lord and the Mother. They're facing each other. At the top, they are there, golden, united. And as the nature side comes down, it's getting a darker and darker and darker blue until there's this deep blue of the inconscient at the bottom of the eight. And then as it rises up, all the rainbow colors come. And that is what he's referring to here. This journey upward gives all the glory of multitudinous mind, all the richness of life's adventure and delight, and all the beauty of all the shapes and hues of matter. On the upward climb, all these things are being carried with the soul as it returns to the origin. For these experiences, the one has chosen to become the many. So next he describes these steps as a scale of music being played, of musical notes being played on an organ. Bhakti, would you read? Mediating, here it is, mediating.
Mediating fixed the heights and the deeps. United the great merit opposites and linked creation to the ineffable.
Thank you. If you've ever heard a powerful organist playing in a vast cathedral and running up the scale, full of the resonance of all the different notes, all the different instruments that the organ can replicate. So they're mounting to their climax, their loudest and highest and fullest expression. But the climax is an endless calm. Each of these notes is a pace, a step of the many-visaged, wonderful, the divine soul which wears all these faces and which is King this return journey. Each of these steps is a measure, a grade of the stature of the growing soul. So all these levels of existence, planes of existence, they interpret existence to itself. The beings who inhabit the universe learn about themselves and their environment through these levels. And they mediate, they form a link between the heights and the deeps. They unite the veiled, married opposites, the Lord, the spirit and nature, the soul and matter. Spirit and matter, the Lord and nature, are united by these different levels. So in this way, the creation is linked to the ineffable, the inexpressible transcendence, which is its origin and constant support.
So, many visages wonderful.
Yes.
Is the wonderful as many facets, or that we see the wonderful in different ways?
Well, the wonderful has so many faces. He wears so many faces. Devin, what do you read?
A last high world was seen where all worlds meet. In its summit gleam when night is not nor sleep. The light began of the Trinity Supreme. All there discovered what it seeks for here. It freed the finite into boundlessness and rose into its own eternity. The incongruent found its heart of consciousness, the idea and feeling groping in ignorance. At last clutched passionately the body of truth, the music born in matter's silences. Plucked new out of the ineffable's fathomlessness, the meaning it had held but could not voice. The perfect rhythm now only sunlight dream, an answer brought to the tone earth's hungry need, rending the night that had concealed the unknown, giving to her her lost, forgotten soul.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything about this passage? I think so, yes. So this is the last high world that he can discern, and beyond that, the light begins of Sat-Chit Ananda. Yes, sometimes it's the three in one. He emphasizes that in the Life Divine, that we tend to think of them as separate things, three things united, but in fact, they are three inseparable aspects of one. What Sri Aurobindo says is that the spirit of Vivekananda came to him and revealed to him the principle of this ascending series of planes of existence.
But that did not include this truth world.
That's right.
And can you say more about that then based on that?
That's what Sri Aurobindo has said, that based on that principle which Vivekananda revealed to him, the supermind was his own discovery. And then when he was studying in the Vedas, he recognized that they were also referring to this last high world. The rishis had some awareness of it, the world of truth consciousness and truth awareness. He doesn't say anything, he does say something about it. But the first characteristic he mentions is that this is where all the worlds come to make together. There's this ladder of step-by-step planes of existence. But in that last high world, all the worlds meet, and all the powers and possibilities.
What's the Trinity?
Amal just mentioned it. In this context, we think of the Trinity as the three aspects of Sat, pure existence, consciousness, and bliss. Sat-Chit-Ananda. This was the formula that the ancient rishis gave for what they considered to be the highest state one could reach without going beyond the manifestation. It's on a kind of borderline. In the planes of existence, in her map, the mother shows these as four worlds, and I can never remember which one comes first, but I think it is Ananda. And then there's tapas, energy, force, consciousness, and pure existence. And the consciousness and force are united, they can't be separated, they're aspects of each other.
It is a transformation flower.
Yes.
If
we hold it up like this, we can see the portals and the descent. Yes, thank you.
I have noticed in the Makyamanya crystal, when they go from meditation and sit in the chair, then the gaze is almost at the top of the crystal. You can see these three lights.
Yes, you can see
the brightest. And when you get up, they become one. I was thinking also this organ scaling, when Mother plays her music, it's like she's just dancing. She's just playing her consciousness up and down, the world's all her own. Just having fun, that's all. Very interesting. Synthesizer, I wonder what she would have created. What sounds would have made?
Yes, she was... wishing, I mean, I think we read about it in the agenda, that she would have liked to have a real full-scale organ. And
maybe she did that through Sunil, he had a synthesizer.
Precisely, he is the one who got the organs later on.
Yeah. Also, I was thinking of that that trident of Shiva, is a symbol of the three. But there's a funny expression in American slang, you know, they say, I'm going to stick it to you. It's like, you know, whenever we get a poke in life, we have to remember it's pitchfork or whatever.
A pitchfork only has two prongs, no? So what's important about this world is that all the world meets there, this last high world. And there, everything discovers, it finds the fulfillment of what it's seeking for here in the material universe. So that world sets the finite, the limited forms of the manifested universe, whether they're material or immaterial, it sets them free into boundlessness. And itself, its uppermost levels, rise into its own eternities. There, even the inconscient, the lowest, densest level, finds its heart of consciousness. And the idea and feeling, groping in ignorance, when they reach that high, last high world, at last is able to clutch passionately the body of truth. And there's a music, so interesting. There's music born in matter's silences. That music that's here can be heard when everything else falls silent. There, it discovers the perfect rhythm, or at first it is able to get hold of, plucked, nude, absolutely pure and without covering, out of that immeasurable state of ineffable. It catches the meaning that was contained in it, but which it couldn't express. The perfect rhythm, which we now might sometimes only dream of, exists there and gives an answer to the torn earth's hungry need. All the suffering that is here in the material universe because of this need to feel that perfect rhythm. When it is experienced, it tears apart the night that had sealed, hidden, the unknown, all that we don't know, all that we may never be able to know. But it gives to her, to earth, her long, her lost, forgotten soul. So this last high world gives the harmonious fulfillment of all the other planes. The description continues, but I think we should stop there. For today, we can listen to Mother reading some of these lines.
In order, sounding is the occult form, the magic for her entry, glittering, quivered in a penumbra of strange light, a core of the mystical traffic of the world, the balcony and miraculous facade. Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.